Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to Fearless with Jason Whitlock. I am Jason Whitlock, your host. Happy Friday to you and yours. We made it. We made it to the weekend. Awesome to be here at the weekend. You know, I love the weekend. And so we're going to try to send you out on a very, very positive, feel-good note this weekend. Zuby, you guys know Zuby from Zuby Music. He's going to be here in studio with me today, and we're going to have a long conversation with Zuby. He's a rapper. He's a motivational speaker. He's a public speaker. He talks a little bit about politics. I think he's been on a lot of different shows and whatever. He's here in Nashville and has granted me an audience. And so we'll get, I've followed Zuby on social media and have wanted to understand and fully understand his full story. And so we'll do that today. But before we do that, you guys have heard me the past couple of weeks, particularly on Wednesdays, talk about the Harmony song that I had made. And I'm very proud of the song. I wish I could sing and could have sang on the song. But the song is incredible. It's awesome. It's custom, no different than you guys hear me talk a lot about Tamara, out my friend from out in California, and she made the Freedom song for me. And so we're trying to build a custom music collection here at Fearless that fits this show perfectly. And so probably a year ago, 10 months ago, I met a woman, Allie Taylor, who's gonna be here with me today, and talk with her. I said, I need a song about harmony, because that's a big part of what we're doing here at Fearless, is we wanna promote racial harmony and just harmony in general among Americans. And so talk with Allie about a concept of a harmony song, and she took it from there and then added some spices of a singer here, I think, that does a little country singing, named Tay Lewis. Incredible. But I'm gonna play the song first, and then we're gonna talk to Allie and Tay about the harmony song. So sit back and enjoy. I think this is about a 2.5 minute, three minute song. Sit back and enjoy this.
How did we end up so divided? Stop fighting and stand tall. Used to be a nation, one united. Now we're headed for downfall. God, let your light shine down. What we need more than anything now, harmony. Let's make a simple vow. Let's come together now. Harmony. Put all your weapons down. Love one another now. Harmony.
Time for us to wake. My brother, see through the lies they tell us. 'Cause together we're so much stronger. God, let your light shine down. What we need more than anything now.
Harmony. Let's make a simple vow. Let's come together now.
Harmony.
Put all your weapons down. Love one another now.
Harmony.
to me. Open up your eyes and see.
Let's start right now in harmony.
Let's make a simple vow. Let's come together now.
Harmony.
Pull all your weapons out. Love one another now.
Harmony.
Together in
harmony. Together. Together.
All right, so that's the harmony song. Hopefully you've heard it before on Wednesdays. We play it at the end of the show every Wednesday. Allie Taylor, Tay Lewis, both here, guys.
Wow.
Thank you so much for joining me. And Allie basically kind of drove this, came up with the hook.
Yes.
And so, Allie, walk me through the process of how you, because I think the hook was amazing. The first time I ever heard it, mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God, she got exactly what I was thinking.
Yay, I'm happy about that. But yeah, I approached my friend Andrew Beeson. He's a good friend and co-writer of mine here in Nashville. And I just kind of took all the notes that you told me. You wanted it about harmony. You wanted that to be the title. And just kind of tried to incorporate that into the song and make it come to life.
And so from the very beginning, I think you mentioned, who has the song Champion? Is that Carrie Bradshaw?
Carrie Underwood?
Carrie Underwood.
Yeah.
I keep saying Carrie Bradshaw. I love talking about Sex and the City. yeah, Carrie Underwood. And it does kind of give me that same feeling mm-hmm. as her song Champion, except it's about harmony.
Yeah, well, you mentioned wanting it to have an epic feel to it, and I tried to just kind of bounce off of that. I was like, I know the perfect song, Champion, Carrie Underwood. We'll try to just make that our own for harmony.
All right, and so I also said I wanted some soul.
Yes.
And Tay Lewis, and there's another young woman on the song, yeah. Davina. What's Davina's last name? Do we know?
She just goes by Davina with her artist name, I'm pretty sure. So
that's all I've known her to be is Davina.
Yeah.
All right, and so how did we find Tay? And Tay, I actually saw a couple of weekends ago, I actually saw Tay perform live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Tay's all around town performing, and so am I. So you run into the same people. Nashville's small, especially with artists.
Yes.
We're just kind of all in the same circles and same groups. So
yeah.
I heard a lot about Tay and your writing and your singing and
yes.
just your great personality in person as well. So I knew you'd be great. The voice, the personality. And then Davina, I actually went to elementary school with Davina in Florida.
Oh, wow.
And I kind of put just a little note out saying, hey, Nashville artists, I'm looking for a female vocal, anyone who's interested. And Davina reached out and I'm like, you're in Nashville? Because we went to elementary school in Florida. So it's kind of a full circle moment to have her on the song with me
yeah.
because I've known her for years now.
So Tay, when you hear about the song and the did you instantly like, oh, I can do this. This fits me.
Oh yeah, as soon as she explained to me what the meaning of the song was supposed to be about, I told her, I said right away, I was like, yes, I'll definitely do that. So it was a great experience just being in the studio with them and with her and meeting mm-hmm. Butter. he's a highlight, just a hoot for real.
Yeah.
But it was an amazing experience just to be able to do that and just to understand the meaning of it really kind of helped me to reel in my artistry, you know, and help me to understand what I'm supposed to do when it comes to like making sure that the song is the way that you want it, you know, mm-hmm. so.
And so the first time I heard it, I was like, hey, I thought y'all told me there was a black male country singer on here. And again, you have a
unique sound.
Yeah, it's, you're kind of like, I would call you the Michael Jackson of country. And, but And so I was surprised. I was like, oh, well, there's black country singers. The only one I know is Charlie Pride.
Yeah.
But are you, is country, is that the lane you're in for sure?
So I am. I am a country singer-songwriter. There is actually a lot of us now I was kind of shocked when I moved to Nashville because I lived in New York for about 3.5 years before I moved here. And when I lived in New York, I didn't realize that there were so many black country singers that were in Nashville that were already doing their thing. Now we have people like Breland, Brittany Spencer, Willie Jones. So we have like so many people that are doing it now who are, you know, heavy, you know, black country artists. And then we have Black Opry who is doing the same thing. So it's great. It's great to see so many, you know, black country artists.
Where are you from? Mixing. Are you originally from New York?
I'm originally from North Carolina.
Oh, because I was going to say, a guy from New York wants to sing country music?
Well, there is some in New York. You know, it's upstate. It's not, you know, in Brooklyn and all those places like that. You don't find a lot. But it's upstate New York is where you find a lot of the country artists that are really wanting to pursue country. But they don't have the nerve to want to move to Nashville because they're like, I'm good where I'm at. So,
and so how long have you been here? How's it been going?
I've been here since January. So I met her through a write with her her boyfriend, Gary.
Yeah.
I was about to say.
Gary Wayne.
With Gary Wayne. And I actually wrote with him. And that's how I actually met her. And it was from there, we just kind of clicked. And so I've been here since January. And I think that was like, in March? It was like March or April,
yeah.
I think. Something like that. So, and we just kind of clicked from there. And that's how we actually met.
Yeah. And Allie, give me a little bit of your backstory in terms of you're from Florida. You went to grade school in Florida.
Yeah.
And how long have you been here? And you're a country singer as well.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I moved around a lot. So was born in New York, grew up in Florida. And that's where a lot of my Venezuelan family members are because my father's from Venezuela. So grew up there with a lot of my family. And then we moved to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And so that's like my more recent hometown, Amish country. And now I'm here, and I came here for school at Belmont University. So I came here for school and then graduated and...
With the plans of being a singer the whole time, or...?
Yeah, well, that was kind of my parents... I'm the first woman on both sides to graduate college, so my parents really encouraged me to go. And they said, well, if you're gonna pursue music, if you want to go to Nashville, then you should go to college. And I'm like, okay, Belmont. And it was just kind of the perfect combo because I was able to go to class and then drive on to Music Row and work at the labels and really get that, and then to a co-write and really be able to have a good balance of working but music and being creative as well.
All right, well, so both of you guys, tell people where they can find your music, what's your best music, how easy can they access, because you guys are both young and up-and-comers, how can people get your work and get your content?
Yeah, I mean, I'm Allie Taylor Music on Instagram, Facebook, even TikTok. Yep, I'm on there.
Gotta get that.
And you can find me on all
what's
of that.
What's your best song? What's the song you've had the most success with, or what you think is your best song that you want people to listen to?
Yeah, I trust the people's opinions. And right now, my duet, Showed Me Love, with Gary Wayne, has almost 600,000 streams, and it's been doing really well. So I would say that's my most popular one right now.
Tay?
Yeah, so you can find me on Tay Lewis Music on Instagram, T-A-E, not T-A-Y. And then on Facebook, it's the same thing, Tay Lewis Music. And then on TikTok, Tay Lewis Music. So I try to make it as easy as convenient for everybody. I mean, pretty much the most prevalent song that I have out right now is I Don't, but the one that everybody has been kind of clicking with a lot is called Love Gone Missing. That hit about 10,000 streams, so that was really good.
Love Gone Missing.
Yes, sir.
Can you sing a little bit of it? Or?
Oh, gosh. I can.
Give us a taste.
Okay. This house ain't home, it's hard to let go of all that I could believe. Give you my best shot to you that I'm not the man that I used to be. Cause our love runs deeper than the way I'm feeling. My heart can't take another, all it's beating. Oh girl, yeah, we gotta stop tripping. Cause you know that our love's gone missing. Yay.
Woo.
Oh man, that's, I gotta be honest. Before I came to Nashville, I knew nothing about country music.
Mm-hmm.
I still only know like a tiny, tiny bit, but I have developed a taste for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Allie through this harmony song, but Allie, you know, you gonna let Tay do the only singing here? You wanna give us a taste of
Come on,
Show
oh,
Me
God.
The Love or something? You know?
Sure. Let's see, put me on the spot. Yeah, there's I guess I can sing some of Showed Me Love. Empty Friday nights and wasted weekends, finding myself lonely in the crowd. Every bad goodbye just left me feeling like there might not be a good man in this town. Heaven only knows just where I'd be if your love never came to set me free. Yeah, when I saw darkness, you showed me light. Fix my heart and show me what it means to live my life.
Wow.
When I went, yeah.
Wow.
It's a little
amazing,
bit.
Right?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I was gonna say you should sing the one
I
you wrote
with Gary. With you.
We gon' party, y'all.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, we can sing that one too, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you guys. I gotta take care of a little business before Zuby gets here.
Yeah, okay. You gotta stop us or we'll do a whole concert
right.
over here.
Right. Okay. You know what? I'm gonna be honest with you. Come back anytime.
Okay.
Yeah, we love that.
Your schedule works, and we can do this again. Maybe we can get Davina here as well.
Yes, that'd be great. She's a school teacher, so.
Yeah, we could certainly get Butter here.
Yes.
he had a little schedule problem. But anyway, thank you guys so much. Let me take care of some business.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With Father's Day coming up and all the summer events and holidays on the horizon, this is the perfect time to try a box of Good Ranchers. If you're looking to surprise your father, grandfather, father-in-law, husband, this is a no-brainer. Good Ranchers is the place to get American beef, chicken, and seafood this summer. They sell 100% American meat and ship it right to your door. And right now, they're giving away two free 18-ounce prime center cut ribeyes to every person that uses my code FEARLESS. That's over 2 pounds of prime ribeye steaks. Just add it to your order at no cost. With Father's Day almost here and the summer stretching out right before us, what's not to love? This is not the time to wait. Claim your ribeyes today before they run out. This is a limited stock item. First come, first up. First come, first serve. And you want to be first with Good Ranchers. They deliver the best of American farms and ranchers to your door. Make sure you take the time today, right now, and go to goodranchers.com/fearless or use my code FEARLESS at checkout to get your two free 18-ounce ribeyes. Start the summer off right with Good Ranchers, American meat delivered. You guys know I love Good Ranchers. You know I love them because they love us. They love our point of view. They love the values. They love America. Be a good soldier. Eat Good Ranchers. Zuby, X. All right, welcome back. Welcome back to a special musical edition of Fearless with Jason Whitlock. We just had on Allie Taylor and Tay Lewis, who put together the great harmony song for us. And as I told you at the top of the show, now our featured guest is here, Zuby Udezu. Did I get that last name right?
Udezwe, close.
Udezwe. I just know him as Zuby Music. I've been following his Twitter feed for a couple of years. It seems like he's an independent rapper from the UK, author of a new book, Candy Calamity, host of a podcast. I don't know if you know this, Zuby, but I used to host a podcast called Real Talk probably 10 years ago. And Zuby's podcast is called Real Talk with Zuby. He's a public speaker, entrepreneur, born in England, but raised in Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, that's right.
You got an interesting background, and that's kind of what I want to get into. I'm fascinated by Zuby, and now I want to learn why and what the backstory is. And so just walk us through, you know, born in England, grew up in Saudi Arabia, lived a bunch of places. Walk us a little bit through your background growing up.
Yeah, sure thing. So I was born, as you said, in England. My parents are originally from Nigeria. That's my family background, Igbo ethnicity to be precise. When I was a baby, I don't remember this, of course, we moved to Saudi Arabia. My dad's a medical doctor. He got a job opportunity to work out over there in the Middle East. And we all went out there, seven of us, my parents, myself, and my four older siblings. And all my earliest memories are in Saudi Arabia. When I was there, I went to an international school. So I was actually in the American school system from kindergarten all the way up until fifth grade. So for anyone who's wondering about my accent and why I don't sound like a typical Englishman, it's because of that. So
I hear a little bit of it.
You'll hear a little bit of it. Okay. Yeah, for sure. I don't sound like 100% American,
gotcha. But
I don't sound British either. So it confuses people in both countries and all over the world. After fifth grade, I actually went to boarding school when I was 11 years old. So I went to boarding school back in the UK from the age of 11. So from 11 to 17, I was in boarding school from, I guess, what would be sixth grade onward. And then I did really well in school. I got top grades and everything, got into Oxford University, studied computer science there for 3 years. While I was in university, that's actually when I started making music and released my first album, when I was in my second year of university. And then after that, I graduated when I was 20, took 1 year out and did my music full time for a year. And then I actually had a corporate job offer and I'd put it off for 1 year to work on my music. But then after that year, I moved to London, worked in the corporate world as a management consultant for 3 years for a big company. And then in November 2011, I took the big leap and became a full-time musician. So I've now been self-employed for over 10 years doing all of my music. To date, I've now put out 6 albums and 3 EPs in total, performed all over the place, and added a lot of additional strings to the bow since then, especially since 2019. That's when I started my podcast. It's when I released my first fitness book, Strong Advice. And it's also when things just started to blow up for me and a lot of people in the USA started to discover me. Up until that point, my audience was primarily in the UK and specifically for my music. And now people know me primarily in the US, but honestly around the world and for a lot of different things.
Yeah, I was gonna ask that because let's say you got 1 million Twitter followers. What percentage of them do you think are American versus the UK? And then work, because if you don't follow Zuby on social media and you don't fully understand, hey, Whitlock's got a rapper on or whatever, but Zuby is far more than just a rapper. You're a public intellectual. Mm. And you've been, I think you've been kicked off of, or suspended for Twitter for, you know, saying the transgender crowd's not a big fan of yours.
I got temporarily suspended for saying, okay, dude, in reply to somebody. That's what I said. The tweet just said, okay, dude.
Oh, you misgendered somebody? Is that what they're arguing?
They were never specific. Someone was boasting about the fact that they sleep with more women than me, and I just said, okay, dude. And then a week later, I got an email from Twitter saying that my account had been locked for hateful conduct. And I was like, wait, what's going on here? Initially, I thought it was like a spam message or something. And then I tried to go on Twitter and yeah, I'm locked out of my account. And the offending tweet is literally, okay, dude. And so I thought it was some type of mistake. I appealed to Twitter and then it got a human review and they confirmed the following day that I'd violated their hateful conduct policy. So of the 100,000 plus tweets I've put out there, the one that went past the line was me saying, okay, dude.
And so did you say okay, dude, before or after you announced you identified as a female and broke some weightlifting records?
Yeah.
And that stuff didn't get you in trouble?
No, that didn't get me in any trouble at all. That was February 2019. So that was the flashpoint. So I've been on Twitter since 2009. And it took me 10 years. At the beginning of 2019, I had about 17,000, 18,000 followers. And that viral deadlift tweet blew up. That's how millions of people across the world discovered me from that, from the Joe Rogan to Tucker Carlson to Piers Morgan, Ben Shapiro, like people all over the map in all these different arenas. That video was seen by millions and millions of people. So that was the flashpoint where that was like a tipping point where I came onto a lot of people's radars, and then through that, people discovered my music and my podcast and my writing and my general thoughts and commentary. And ever since then, it's just been growing and growing and growing.
So if you want to grow your social media account, identify as a woman.
Yeah, female that, privilege.
Yeah, that will do it for you. Wow. And so you said in 2019, you had 17, 18,000 followers. Yeah. And now how many do you have?
On Twitter, 820,000.
Yeah.
Across the board, I think about 1.3 million.
And so I'm sure that's benefited and fueled your rap career and business and helped you get financially sound and successful.
Yeah, definitely. And it's been a long grind. As I said, I put out my first album in 2006. So I think a lot of people don't realize how long I've been grinding on everything I do for. There's so many people, probably 99% of people who know me discovered me in the last 3 years, which is fine. But I think there's a lot of those people who missed out on the decade plus of real hustle that came before all of that. So some people might see it and go, oh, you know, he just put out one tweet and things blew up. And it's like, No. There's a lot of grind that came before that, and a lot of grind that's come after it as well. I mean, that was February 2019, so that could have been a flash in the pan and then faded out and disappeared, as many things do. Lots of things go viral on the internet, but I've been able to maintain and sustain that and really continue to grow my audience and the amount of people I'm reaching through all the different channels of what I do. And honestly, life is really beautiful right now. Things are at a really exciting stage. I've sort of tipped into a whole new phase of my career and my life. And there's no one who does what I do in the combination that I do it, right? I mean, there are rappers, there are authors, there are podcasters, there are fitness people, there are socio-political commentators and so on. But what I'm doing and what I'm building in combination is totally unique. So that's interesting, and there's some trepidation around that, because sometimes I'm like, man, like I don't even know exactly what I'm doing, or like where this all goes in the future. Where will things be 5 years from now, a decade from now? It's kind of hard to predict. You know, it's going to be a lot bigger, but I'm grateful to have opportunities like this. I mean, the fact that I'm even in the USA and there are so many people here showing love and wanting to talk to me and work with me on different projects, even just knowing who I am. I mean, I'm an independent rapper from the UK. I'm not someone who had like millions of pounds or dollars pumped into their marketing budget, or who was plastered all over TV or anything like that. It's been really, really organic. I used to sell my CDs on the street. That's how it started. I mean, I did that for over a decade. That used to be the main source of my revenue. And then I started doing pop-up shops in different shopping malls in the UK, where I'd sell my CDs and sell my merchandise. So the fact that I'm even able to travel around the USA and have all these cool opportunities and build projects and connect with great people in different arenas, for me, that's just a huge blessing. And I don't take it for granted.
Help, and I know artists hate to compare themselves or be compared to some other artist, but just help an average American rap music fan, like, is there some American rapper that you'd say, maybe I'm in that lane, just to help people understand your musical career?
Sure. In terms of my style of music, I found that, I mean, I could certainly say which, if people listen to certain artists, then there's a good chance they'll like my music. I found that a lot of people who like artists, and there's quite a broad range actually, Tech N9ne, Kanye West, Nas, stuff like Gangstar, Jay-Z to some extent. I'd say people who are fans of
lyrics.
Some of those artists. Yeah, I'm a lyrics guy. I'm about the words. I'm about wordplay.
When you say
about
Tech N9ne, message. You're talking to, that's, I know Tech N9ne forward and backwards.
Yeah.
The Alpha and the Omega. And, yeah. I know, and so that to me, when you say Tech N9ne is one of the first names out of your mouth, incredible lyrics, and it's like when you the music's good, it may make you want to dance, but you want to lock in. This guy's about to tell you a story.
Yeah,
he's about to say something to make you think, and What's your most popular song?
Probably OK Dude. I made a song called OK Dude, and I'd say recently, over the past few years, that's my most popular one.
And so obviously it's about what happened to you, but can you give me a little taste?
Inspired by it more than directly about it. It's funny because Joe Rogan actually does the intro on it, because he talked about the whole OK Dude situation and me getting deplatformed from Twitter on his podcast. So I took the clip from that and actually used it for the intro of the song. So the track is related to that. It's more inspired by it than telling the story of it. But it's really, honestly, it was getting a lot of stuff off my chest, because I put out an album in 2019, and then I had this whole whirlwind of craziness and travel and interviews and suddenly coming on a lot of people's radar. And it's also when I started getting a lot of backlash and flack for some of the things that I was saying, because suddenly I was kind of elevated to this position where you're more visible. So the more visible you are, the more people are going to attack you on social media. So I wanted to just address all of that. So the song goes into a lot of different things and was kind of just like airing out and venting some of the things that people had been saying. So yeah, that's one of my most popular songs.
And then, so I listened, your dad's a doctor.
That's right.
I would imagine your mom's pretty smart too.
Very.
You're very smart, went to Oxford. What do you think about a lot of rap, American rap, is pretty stupid. And you're really smart.
Yeah.
What do you think about what has happened to rap? Because I'm 55. Mm. I was at rap at the very beginning. And I love rap the most when it was KRS-One and Public Enemy and even an X-Clan. And just that whole era where there was a consciousness and it felt like rap was going to really educate and elevate black culture, and then it went another direction. And I'm just outsider who obviously probably inspired by American rappers.
Yeah.
What do you think of where rap music has gone?
It's a great question. I'll be honest, I think when it comes to this particular topic, I do think that everybody tends to have a little bit of a bias on it based on their age and what they kind of grew up with. Because nonsense rap has always existed. Unlyrical rap that's just about partying or women or flexing or jewelry and car, that's always existed.
Rapper's Delight is a silly song.
Yeah, it's been there.
Yeah.
So, and there is plenty of deep, conscious, strong storytelling, great lyrics.
Now?
There is now. There is, right? There's also the mumble rap and there's also nonsense and party music. And
does any of it get played on radio or anywhere?
In the States, I don't really know, to be honest. Yeah. I don't really know how much of it gets played on the radio here. I think that one of the problems with hip hop is that the truth is, I think, and people could have a whole debate about why this is, but a lot of the degenerate stuff is pushed to the forefront in the mainstream. So I think a lot of people, especially if they're not really into hip hop, what they hear and what they judge it on is off a few songs and artists that they're hearing on the radio or in the club and so on, right? Because that's what's popping, right? Like that's what is getting more attention. At the same time, you have got artists like Kendrick Lamar, J. Cole, even Drake to some degree, Logic, and so on, who are selling crazy records, selling out huge shows. So there are artists who are saying stuff and aren't just rapping nonsense, who are doing extraordinarily well, even in that mainstream lane. In fact, they're doing better than the mumble rappers. So I think there's a little bit of bias at play when people discuss this. But I also think that when it comes to any genre of music, and hip hop for sure, you've always got the range. One thing that I tend to take issue with, certainly when it comes to mainstream and what's pushed out there on the big channels, is one of balance, right? I think if all you're putting out there is the gangsta stuff and the stuff promoting drugs and promoting having sex with everybody and how much money you've got and all that, and it's completely lopsided, and that's all, you know, someone driving in the car, listening to the radio, if that's all they're getting, then I think that's a problem. So I think that balance has certainly shifted over time. I think the balance used to be better in that you could turn on the radio and you'd hear more lyrical rap and stuff with a better message and so on. But I think now they've kind of gone more towards that sort of fast food lane music way. Honestly, the same thing has happened with food as well. You know, there's still plenty of great food out there, but the stuff that is pushed and promoted and you're hearing the ads for or whatever, it's typically not going to be the best stuff for you.
Not, that's another area I'm an expert on. Rap and food are two areas I know well and have had a problem with both of them. Let me ask you probably a little bit of a difficult question, but one of the things that like drives me crazy about rap now is its over-reliance on the N-word. Mm. I can go back and listen to the rap from the 90s, 2000s, where it might get said occasionally. But now, it's almost, I wonder, like, are rappers paid by the N-word? Is there some kind of incentive for relying on the N-word? And that's what drives, because I can't listen to it. Mm. I can't roll my windows down and listen to it because it's embarrassing. I'm like, I'm a grown man, and somebody, bitch, hoe, N-word, is there, and this is the last question I'm going to ask you along these lines.
No, it's okay.
Is there some sort of, I've literally asked, like, is there some sort of, do they sit you in a room and say, hey guys, you only said the N-word 10 times on this song and our quota is 15. It must be 15. Is that what's going on?
Man, I mean, I've used that word in precisely zero of my songs in my entire career, so I can't speak on everybody else, but I'm also totally independent, so I don't know what goes on behind those closed doors. The truth is as well, and this is, I think a lot of times people ask why rappers rap about certain things or use certain words and so on. And I honestly think a much more interesting question is why do so many people listen to it and buy it? Because it's a supply and demand thing to some degree, right? I think, you know, rather than asking, okay, why do rappers rap about these subjects? It's like, well, why are millions of people why are people buying it and streaming it in droves, and that's what they want to listen to? And I think that's kind of a deeper and more uncomfortable question. And I think that human beings, I mean, you could say the same with other forms of entertainment, video games, movies, right? People like violence and sex and stories about drugs and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I think the biggest issue is when that line between entertainment and reality gets blurred. And that happens quite a lot, especially within the world of hip hop. But I think it comes to, you know, just economic supply and demand, because as long as it keeps on selling and people keep playing it, why would a rapper be incentivized to change? And I think that's a shame, but that's not my view, obviously. I mean, when it comes to my own music and everything that comes out of my mouth, I represent me and I put out the message that I want to put out. But just looking at it as to why I think that's the case, I think that's a part of it. And I don't think those artists' morals or principles or so on supersedes the, you know, the desire to just make money and put out what they know to be popular.
I think we've built a culture that
degrades itself.
No question, but has also, in some way, and this leads us down another path, but it's like Black people, our identities are caught up in being a victim. Mm-hmm. That's the highest level of Blackness, being a victim. And other than being a victim, the other way to show that, hey, I'm really Black and I'm leaning into my Black identity is, again, I don't know, you can't relate to it because you didn't grow up here in America. Mm-hmm. But the thing you can do, particularly if you've had some success and maybe you came from the hood, but if I can litter my conversation with the N-word, mm-hmm. I feel authentically Black and I haven't sold out. And so that's, they've tapped into that. And so I'm wondering, as a dark-skinned person from another country, mm-hmm. what do you think about the victimhood culture that we have going on here in America?
I don't like it. It's something I speak out against a lot. And it's, this is so deep. It's a big problem. I mean, I have a theory that this is the, you know, if people want to talk about institutional and systemic racism persisting in the modern era, like, this is it. It's telling black people, black Americans in particular, that they are somehow lesser than. And it's not being told that explicitly, but okay, we're talking about music. If an artist of any other race or ethnicity made a song explicitly talking about killing people of their own race or ethnicity, if a Chinese rapper or if a Jewish rapper made a song about killing Jewish people, or a white rapper made a song about killing white people, people would be like, what's wrong with this person? He's insane. But people have become so numb. People have become so numb over the decades about black people rapping about killing other black people that this question is not even asked. It's just assumed by everyone. Oh yeah, that's just normal. There's no shock value. And at the same time, people are there, you know, saying, you know, Black Lives Matter, or, you know, we need to treat each other better, or other people need to treat us better, and so on. And it's like, man, so much of this problem is internal. And when you hold that mirror up, I mean, as an outsider, it's even worse. But if that mirror is held up, it makes people so uncomfortable, and they lash out. And it's such a huge shame, because you know that if that mentality is rejected and people don't see themselves as lesser than and don't assume that everyone else around them is trying to put the boot down on them and hold them down and so on, then they can go on and achieve incredible greatness. I mean, in the United States of America, and maybe one issue is that, sadly, Americans don't travel internationally very much. And so the worldview is so insular and so focused on the U.S. past and present that people lack both perspective and gratitude. This doesn't just apply to black Americans. It applies to, I think, Americans in general. But people don't realize just, like, if you are in the USA and you're an American in 2022, regardless of your skin color, gender, sexuality, whatever, like, the amount of opportunity in this country, like, I can guarantee you no one is oppressing you more than you're oppressing yourself. Guaranteed. People don't care enough. People don't care to oppress you, right? Like, no one is gonna be like, oh, this guy's black, we're gonna, it's not 1920, right? It's 2022. So when people are still grasping onto this so desperately and making it their whole identity, it's like, man, that's what's holding that person back. That is the problem. And it makes me sad to see this on a daily basis. I see it on social media all the time. I'm hearing it in what people are saying and so on. And it's just like, man, and unfortunately, there's an industry around it as well, which makes it even worse. There's this whole grievance industrial complex where they want to lock people into this way of thinking. Even if they become incredibly successful, it's like you're still supposed to have this type of mentality. And ultimately, it's destructive. Ultimately, it's destructive. And I know that there are, you know, some black Americans out there who don't like me speaking on this as like a British person. You know, people don't want to hear criticism from an outsider or something like that. But the only reason that criticism even exists is because I want to see people do well. I don't like to see people oppressing themselves and holding themselves down. I like to see people achieve potential and achieve greatness. So any type of criticism is more like holding up a mirror going, oh, look, like, maybe you can sort out this thing yourself. It can't be sorted out externally. Not everything can be fixed externally if it's an internal problem. And yes, history can be acknowledged and should be, and people should know history and why certain things are the way they are and so on. But it's like, you can't drive a car with your head stuck backwards, right? You have to look forward. You can check the side mirrors and check behind you occasionally to, you know, orient yourself. But you've got to focus on forward, because you can't change history, not on a nation level, not on an individual level, not on a group level. History is history. There's so many things in history I wish we could press a button and go back and change and make it so that something never happened. But in the here and now, all you can do is make choices and do things that are going to move you forward. So that's a core part of my message. I think that particularly resonates with certain people, but honestly, people across the board. That's really one of my core messages. And I don't like to see Black Americans or Black people in general, anyone in general, being, you know, emotionally manipulated or being used as a political football, which you see all the time, and, you know, just having their feelings used against them, essentially.
And so you have lived and traveled a lot of places.
Yeah.
And so do I hear you saying that for your skin color, there's more opportunity here than the other places you have lived and traveled?
Yes, including my country of the UK. The US, people don't get how much the size and scale and scope and wealth of this nation and the way things are laid out is unique globally. There are plenty of developed countries, right? Take my country, the UK. I mean, the whole UK, which is four countries, Northern Ireland, England, Scotland, Wales, the whole UK is smaller than Texas, right? Has a bigger population, but geographically it's smaller. You've got places like Australia, 20 million people, Canada, 30 million people, the USA, 340 million people. You've got what, four different time zones, gigantic place, one of the wealthiest countries in the world in terms of equality and fairness under the law. No one is being, again, history was different, but right now, laws are equal. There's nothing on the books that's gonna stop you, regardless of your class, whether you're rich, you're poor, you're Black, you're white, you're straight, you're gay, you're a man, you're a woman. Like, if you can't make something out of it here, then, you know, like that's honestly on you. It's not on you where you start, but where you finish, that's on you. And there's countless stories. Hundreds of millions of people have started out in not a great place, and then they've strived and they've made good decisions and they've gone on to live fantastic lives. So it's not like there's a lack of examples or something like
that. What would you say to the people that hear that and go, this guy's dad was a doctor. He went to private school.
I did. I own all that. I own all that, but
he doesn't know what he's talking about.
But isn't that funny that we're living in a time where being privileged is considered a bad thing? If you don't come from privilege, you should try to strive to make sure your children do, right? And even when people talk about privilege, they talk about this such a narrow lens, right? My point is that it's on you. Is life harder or easier for some people in different ways, in all shapes and? Everyone has their different struggles, different advantages, different pros, different cons. But as I said, if you are, honestly, if you live in the West in general, and you have a Western passport or citizenship, and you are able-bodied, and you don't have some gigantic, like crazy health issues or something, you want to talk about privilege. You're already in the 1% of humanity that's ever walked the face of this earth. You're already better off than almost everybody who's ever existed, even if you are not in perfect circumstances, even if you don't come from the best family or you don't grow up in the best neighborhood. What you have here is you have the capacity to move up. Why do so many people want to move to countries like the USA? It's because there's no ceiling here. Right, so there's plenty of places where you could be born. You know, you could be born in a village in Ethiopia, and you're smart, you're hardworking, you've got good character, good principles. But where you are, the ceiling is just very low. No, even if you work really, really hard, like you're just capped. Unless you go and venture off to somewhere else, a bigger city, a different country, somewhere else where you can really, really elevate. You're always going to be capped. And that's why so many people want to come here. That's why people want to come here from South America, from Central America, from Europe, from all over. And I'm saying this again as someone who's from England. Like, England is a great country in its own regard. But I would say in terms of opportunity and scale, it doesn't even compare
and
to
so
the U.S.
You and I come from opposite spectrums. My dad didn't graduate high school. My mother was a factory worker. In 1984, my senior year of high school, me and my father lived in a one-bedroom, 400-square-foot apartment in the hood. And I was born with some privilege. One, I had two parents that were committed. Mm-hmm. Even my parents divorced, but both committed to me. And then two, I was blessed with enough athleticism to get mm-hmm. a college football scholarship. Mm. And that's all I needed.
Yep.
That parents, that scholarship, and my Christian faith mm-hmm. launched me and allowed me to go places where no one in my family has ever gone.
Yeah. And being born on this patch yes. of land.
Yeah, and right. here in America, yeah. that's a privilege yeah. that we all just take for granted. And so how would the message that you push out, how much flack do you get back for doing that?
I get plenty, and it's, you know, I mostly get love, first of all. I think it's important to realize it's like 90-10 or 95-5, right? Most people who know me really like what I do and understand the intention of the message that I put out there. But I think the reason why some people don't like it is the same reason why some people get mad when someone promotes healthy living and exercise and diet, anything that puts personal responsibility on people and holds up a mirror which could make them go, maybe I have some internal, maybe I'm part of the issue.
Yeah.
People don't like that. A lot of people don't like that. It's uncomfortable for almost everybody, but some people will own that and be like, yeah, you know what? Yeah, that's right. Like, I can do something about that. And that's empowering, right? Like, we all fall short in various ways, but knowing that, hey, I can do something about this. I'm broke now, but I can take steps that will, you know, put me on a path to prosperity. Or, you know what? I'm not in the best shape right now, but I can alter my diet and my lifestyle habits, and I can exercise, and I can change that, right? So actually, it's a very empowering message, but I think why it can trigger people is because it takes away the alibi. People like to have an alibi. People like to have something external that is the reason that they can use for any type of failure, right? And we all do this to some degree, right? If you're booked for something and you get there late, you know, people will say, oh, you know, it was traffic or it was this. Truth is, you left too late, right? You should have left earlier, and that's on you. But our natural thing, it's literally the oldest story in the Bible, right? What happened, you know, and when Adam ate the fruit and he said, oh, it was that woman. She told me to do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very natural human thing. So I think that there are a lot of people who like the idea of systemic or institutional or structural racism and sexism and homophobia and transphobia and all these types of bigotry, and this notion that there's just some entity out there, whether it's the patriarchy or it's white supremacy or it's whatever, there's some invisible force out there that's stopping them from succeeding, because if you pull that away from them, then they have to realize, oh, actually, it's on me. And I think it's also what leads to that type of hater mentality, when someone sees someone else who is successful, and instead of being inspired by it, they get triggered and they get angry and they feel jealous, because they see, oh, well, they'd like to think that, oh, well, everyone who's like me can't do this thing. But then, I mean, you just told your story, so you're a shining example that, oh, look, someone can come from this place and have this background and be very successful. So if I'm not successful, what does that say about me and my decisions and my choices? So I think that's at a deeper level, I think that's why some people have that type of reaction to it and will try to say that, you know, it was easy for you, or you had this, or you were lucky, or whatever. And some of those things can be true, right? I don't get defensive if someone says, oh, well, you know, you're lucky, your dad's a doctor, you're lucky. I'm like, yeah, you're correct. I am lucky. My children will be lucky too, because I will be their father. So they're gonna have some type of luck or advantage. But shouldn't we all strive for that to ideally be the case? Like, we should be trying to make, let's try to make more people lucky. Let's create an environment individually and collectively where more people can be of privilege.
So I think I read or heard somewhere, did you have an incident with the police where they misidentified mm-hmm. you, and tell that story, and
sure.
how come you're not mad as hell about it?
Yeah, sure. That was back in 2009. So I'd actually been out after I'd finished university and I was taking a year out doing my music full time. I'd actually been out in a city just promoting and selling my CDs on the street, passing out flyers and stuff like that. And I got on a train. I went back to my hometown, and I came out at the train station.
And this is in the UK?
This is in the UK. So you have to remember, in the UK, the normal police aren't armed, right? So, but they have firearm units. So if there is a high threat, someone with a gun, terrorist threat, something like that, they'll deploy, you know, the big boy police, the armed police. So there were like two or three armed police units at the train station. And I step out of the train and I hear shouting, "Get down, stand back." Well, I look up and I'm like, "Whoa, what's going on?" And then one of them forcibly pushes me backwards. And I look up and I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 guns just trained on me, right? And they're yelling, "Get down on the floor, get down." And so it felt very surreal, but you know, I lay down on the floor as instructed, put my hands up, they put cuffs on me, told me I'm under arrest for a Section 1 firearms offense, and I have no idea at this time, no idea what's going on. It doesn't even feel real. And then, you know, they march me off and take me to this room, and they're interrogating me and asking me all these questions, about threatening someone with a firearm and this and that, in a city I hadn't even been to. Right? I'd been in a city called Southampton. They were saying this happened in Basingstoke. I was like, I haven't been to Basingstoke today. So very quickly, I didn't know what was going on, but very quickly I realized, okay, this is mistaken identity. So whilst I was shaken up and very confused, I was also relatively calm because I knew I hadn't done anything. So I don't know who they thought I was, exactly what they thought I'd done, but I was like, well, my conscience is clear. I haven't done anything. So this will be resolved, right? I don't know how long it'll take, but it'll be resolved. Anyway, you know, they took me over. I'm there like in cuffs being escorted. People must have thought I was some, you know, Pablo Escobar, big deal drug dealer or something. There were a lot of people at the station. So everyone was, you know, like there was a lot of commotion. And then I was put in the cop car. I was riding in the cop car with these, they took me to the station. I was in the station for about 10 minutes, and then someone came out looking very sheepish and was like, I'm so, so sorry. We got the wrong person. Unlocked the cuffs, you know, check that I was okay, offered to drive me back home and so on. And that was that. And then there was a whole media storm after it, which was crazy. That was just as crazy as the incident because it was on the front cover of several newspapers the following day. That there had been this
mistaken identity.
Yeah.
That was the story that was on the paper.
Yeah, but also, again, something like this is pretty rare, especially in the UK, actually. It's pretty rare. So there was all this speculation about what it was. Did they think I was a terrorist or this, or was it a racial incident or so on? You know, everyone had their assumptions and biases and narratives. And then all these different platforms wanted me to interview me and talk about it. And interestingly, you know, like our previous conversation is, you could tell some of them wanted me to play the race angle or to be more angry and more accusatory than honestly I actually was. I was upset, obviously, right? And I was annoyed, but I also didn't want to jump to conclusions myself because it was decided very quickly that, okay, this is going to go to the Independent Police Commission, and they're going to do a whole investigation, find out what went wrong that led to this incident. So I was like, all right, let me wait and see what actually happened. And that went on for several months. But yeah, that was that whole incident.
From start to finish, from like the moment they pushed you down to the moment they unlocked the handcuffs and said, "Hey, we screwed up." Mm. How long was that?
I'd say about an hour. About an hour.
That's a bad experience.
Yeah, it wasn't pleasant.
Yeah, I had something similar, but not that bad, where they didn't take me off, they didn't put me in cuffs, but certainly accused me for an hour on the side of the highway. And you're shaken up and all that, but what I've tried to tell people is like, because I'm a speeder, I talk about this on the show, I've been pulled over a lot because I like to drive fast. And let's say I've been pulled over 30, 40 times. Mm. I've had one bad experience with the police.
Yeah.
And so I can't generalize about all police and policing if I've had one bad experience out of 40.
Yeah.
It seems like I generalize the other way because I've had more experiences where I kill the cop with kindness and get out of a speeding ticket, mm-hmm. then I've had bad experiences.
Yeah. Well, I think the truth about humanity, and this goes across everything, is that we are generally far more sensitive to negative experiences and negative emotions than the positive ones. And there's this bias where if something bad happens once, then people have a tendency to cast that across, whether it's an entire demographic or just shape their entire worldview or anything like that, and they'll just ignore the positive or the neutral stuff, right? I mean, if let's say, for example, I mean, I don't know how many police interactions there are with Americans every year. I would assume it is hundreds of millions of police interactions every year. Now, 99.9% of those are not going to make the news, right? There's nothing interesting, it's mundane, everything goes as it's supposed to, whoever's in the right, whoever's in the wrong, whatever, it's not interesting. But when something does go wrong, that blows up nationally, internationally, and so on, and people are like, oh, this is everyday life in America, this is it, this is America, this is what, and it's like, well, how is the 0.1% case now representative of the daily thing, right? So I understand why people feel that way, but I think it's one of those cognitive biases. I just think it's a cognitive bias that it stands
victimhood.
Out.
I've seen so many people take so much pride in telling their story about their exaggerated bad experience with police.
Sure.
And it's a way of saying, see how black I am? Mm. I had a bad experience with the cops.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you that. So, again, living in the UK, that's all you see because that's all you hear in the media, right? Because, like I said, normal interactions don't make the news and they don't go viral. So you could be sitting in the UK or any other country, and every time you hear about, you know, you hear about the USA, it's a shooting, it's a cop killing someone, it's some racist incident happening in a park or in a school or something. So someone can sit there, especially someone who's never been to the US before, right? And this runs both ways. I know Americans who think that people in the UK are all running around with knives, stabbing each other, and that London is super dangerous because there's people, you know, who are getting stabbed, and there's grooming gangs and so on and so forth. And I'm like, that, I mean, does that exist? Yes, just like shootings do exist in the USA. But you know, there's people who will not travel to the USA because they're afraid of getting shot. Right?
Yeah.
Now, could you get, do shootings happen in the US? Yes, but should you not ever in your life travel to the country because you're, so it's like being afraid to go outside because you could get hit by lightning. It's like, it's possible. But if we're talking probabilities, if you're just minding your business and you're not involved in some gang or criminal activity or something, the chance of you getting shot or stabbed in the UK or in the US is very, very, very low.
Well, you come down on the Second Amendment here.
I support it, which is quite rare for a Brit, but yeah, I definitely support.
And so clearly you understand, like, it's central to freedom.
Yes.
That you take the guns away from people, there's a lot less freedom.
I actually think it's central to global freedom. I'd go that far. I think the USA's Second Amendment is not important just to Americans. I think it's important globally, because I think this country, for all its pros and cons, I think this is truly the bastion of freedom on a global level. So I think even if you look at the past 2.5 years, right, people balk at the idea of a government becoming tyrannical, but look at the past 2.5 years and look at what happened in so many European countries, in Australia and Canada, like under whatever guise, you know, the USA can only be pushed to a certain level when it comes to authoritarianism.
Yeah, they can't come knocking on your door and force the vaccine on you because you may have a gun.
Yes, there's a level to it. And so I think the USA and its Second Amendment actually stands against that type of threat on a global scale. And it's something I've thought about a lot. And again, being someone who's not from the country but spends a lot of time here and knows a lot of people across the political aisle, I can totally understand both sides. I do understand the people who are just like, just ban the guns, just get rid of the guns are the problem. I get that, that's the typical British mentality. That's actually how most people in the world, certainly in the Western world, think. So I do understand that perspective. I don't just think it's like stupid and dismiss it, but fundamentally, most of the time, the people saying that don't understand what the Second Amendment is or why it exists. They don't understand what the existing gun situation even is. There's people who think you can just, you know, walk into Walmart and buy a bazooka if you're 7 years old without any background check. So people, you know, people will talk about, well, you shouldn't be able to buy machine guns in Walmart. And I'm like, you can't buy machine guns in Walmart, right? But they'll say it, and even people who are quite prominent and supposed to be quite smart, but you know, there's this real emotional thing, especially when it comes to guns. And I get that, you know, if you, they can look big and scary. But yeah, when it comes to the US, I definitely support it.
Zuby, I could talk to you forever. I hope you come back to Nashville again so we can do this again.
Sure.
As soon as possible. This was fascinating. I didn't even get to ask you about the book you're writing. But you're as interesting as you come across on Twitter and social media. It's great to meet you. Continued success. And we'd love to have you back.
Thanks, Jason. Appreciate it.
All right, that's tomorrow. We'll see you next week.
I want freedom. No negotiation, my sister, no relation. We all just want to have freedom. Sitting on a corner, never been alone. I'm breaking my back for freedom. Bless, we are living, get back. We are receiving, all deceiving. We all want to be free. We want freedom. I just want, I wanna be, I just want.